Today's program has been brought to you by GreatBrewers.com, a social media marketing platform dedicated to promoting the world's great brewers and the beers they create. For more information, visit GreatBrewers.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. We're doing a special pre-record today at Jimmy's Number 43 with Hugh Sisson, the founder of Heavy Seas Brewing from Baltimore, Maryland. Hugh, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here and all the pirate glory. So, cheers.
So you're a legend. You know, you're Baltimore, Maryland. The Ravens won the Super Bowl.
We get lucky every now and then.
And people are starting to talk about Maryland again.
Well, they're actually beginning to talk about the Baltimore Orioles, which may be a sore subject here, but certainly warms the cockles of me heart, it does.
That's great. So you have a good story. So tell us how you got started. Apparently, when you started, you couldn't make beer in Maryland?
I was in the bar restaurant business for 15 years. The pub that my family owned became sort of a beer joint. This is way early in the day, so this is like 1980. I think we were the first draft Guinness account in the state of Maryland, for example. So we decided in the mid-80s that we wanted to go into being a brew pub, which was really a radical concept at the time. It wasn't legal. We had to get a bill passed in the Maryland legislature, which we got done in 1987, much to my surprise. And so we decided if we got the damn work done, we better be the first guys to get it done. So we opened Maryland's first brew pub in August of 1989.
Were there other microbreweries in Maryland at the time?
There was one other. It was a company called, I can't remember the name of it anymore because they're gone. So, yeah, there were a couple of other small breweries. We were easily the first brew pub. There was somebody else who opened, I think, 4 or 5 months after we did. And, of course, now brew pubs are almost commonplace. But
And we're also here with Ken Zuckerman, who's marketing for Heavy Seas Brewery. Welcome, Ken.
Thank you very much. Happy to be here.
Ken, tell us what we're drinking today.
All right. So you're starting off with the flagship brand for Heavy Seas, the Loose Cannon. In my opinion, it's been a go-to favorite of mine. I live in Boston, actually, for quite a while. It has that perfect balance between the grapefruit that you get at a hops, as well as the pine. A little higher on the alcohol end.
Oh,
so yeah, just wouldn't have too many of these before operating a motor vehicle. But I love IPAs that are really, really balanced, and I love the grapefruit.
I've had this before, and I've had it on draft, and it's really popular.
Yeah, it does really well for us. I think the focus that we've really tried to take with this beer is to get the balanced flavors. Too many IPAs are so focused on the bitterness. And to me, if it doesn't make you want to have a second beer, that's not a winning proposition, either for the restaurant owner or for the brewery owner. So we want them to be balanced enough and go well enough with food that it's kind of ask you for the second beer. That's what it's all about.
So let's go back to the beginning. So you've changed some legislation.
So I got the legislation changed, and then we had the family brew pub, and I ran that for another 5 years, and then in 1994 I decided to leave to go just focus on the beer side. So it took me a year to write the business plan, raise the money, et cetera, and build the facility. And so we started Clipper City Brewing Company, which is the corporate name of my company, in December of 1995. So we're a little over 17 years in.
Great. And how did you guys grow? I mean, from a brew pub to being distributed in New York and other states.
Well, it's a long, slow process. I mean, it doesn't happen overnight. Our first brand was called Clipper City. We acquired another company called the Oxford Brewing Company about 3 years in. And then I guess about 9 or 10 years ago, we decided we wanted to create a third brand, which was called Heavy Seas. And the Heavy Seas brand was easily the most successful of our brands. So we, about 3 years ago, decided to roll everything under the Heavy Seas brand name and eliminated the Clipper City and the Oxford product lines. And that's just been, it's been a great story. I mean, you know, it's a pirate theme. Who the hell doesn't like pirates? You know, we hand out eye patches when we do promotions and stuff like that. And I have yet to find anybody, even if they were not drinking my beer, who didn't want the damn eye patch.
So what other beers did you bring us today?
We brought you a couple of really interesting things. I mean, we had the Loose Cannon to start. I have a beer called Plank 2, which is from a special project that we do. This is pretty interesting. This is, what we do with this is, it's almost a deconstructed kind of beer. Instead of putting the beer in the barrel, we put the barrel in the beer. And the idea here is to do things with beer and wood that have never been done before. So this particular beer, we made a German-style Doppelbock base, and then we aged it for, I think, about another 8 weeks on a combination of poplar and eucalyptus wood boards or planks that were reddified, which means that they're kilned about a third of the way to charcoal. So what you get is this really nice malty beer with these really nice, subtle, slightly smoky, and then rounded wood tones that come through in the finish. This was chosen by Draft Magazine and one of the top 25 beers of 2012.
I'll tell you, it's really nice, and when I saw the label that said Doppelbock, I was intrigued because I think that's a great style.
It is a great style.
Great job.
Thank you.
Yeah, we can toast on there and clink it. Yeah. So you got Plank. And Ken, how did you start working with these guys?
I had met Hugh quite a while ago. I used to actually work for Draft Magazine as well. I've always loved that intersection of craft beer and food pairing. Certainly, your restaurant has really distinguished itself in that arena. And what really attracted me to Heavy Seas, besides the overall quality of the beers, is for a fairly small to middle size brewery and quickly growing now, they make an incredibly wide range of great beer styles, which lots of other breweries do not do. So I really respected the fact that they were adopting and putting out so many great examples of different beer styles, but always with like an American twist to them. So Hugh and I sort of met. I've reached out to Hugh a couple times, involved him in some other events that I've done in the craft brewing industry, and I just think Hugh, particularly with his background, very, very wine-based, as well as beer-based and food, he's sort of that perfect storm of all those pieces coming together.
I.e. the perfect storm.
That's it.
Right.
The pirate.
Right.
So you started with the brew pub, and do you still have the brew pub?
No, I don't. That was a family thing, and then after I left, they eventually sold it. We do have a trademark licensing arrangement with a Heavy Seas Ale House in the Baltimore area, so we do have a flagship sort of retail platform that we can point to. And with any luck, we'll be opening some more locations for that. But so I'm not in the restaurant business.
So
I don't get the phone calls when the toilet backs up. I love it.
So where's the brewery? It's in Baltimore?
We're just outside of Baltimore City, about 10 to 12 minutes from where Camden Yards is where the Orioles play. So it's pretty convenient. It's about 8 minutes from the airport. So it's a nice spot. Just big old industrial building, about 40,000 square feet.
Great.
So we brew.
This is nice. What's the next one?
The next one is going to be the Siren Noir. Now, we created a new series this year called Uncharted Waters. And the idea here is to do some interesting experimental styles. This one is an Imperial Stout that is infused with Belgian chocolate flavors basically by dry hopping on cocoa nibs and then aged for 4 weeks in what happened to be this case Buffalo Trace bourbon barrels. So you get that interesting interplay between the cocoa and then the sort of the vanilla oak characteristics with a little bit of that coconut that also comes from the vanilla oak. I think it's pretty awesome stuff.
Yeah, the cocoa nibs and vanilla really come through. Well, Hugh, it's so great that he came. Hugh's up here. You don't come to New York that often, do you?
I actually come to New York. Yeah. Probably, I don't know, 5 to 9 times a year, and be coming a little more often, which I'm looking forward to doing.
That's great. No, thanks for taking the time. I mean, we got a call. We're not doing our regular show today. We're here in the back room at Jimmy's number 43, and I'm sitting with Brie O'Connor, the producer, and we're tasting through the Heavy Seas line. Do you guys have other beers that are just more sessionable?
Oh, yeah.
These are really awesome beers.
These are the
great
big ones,
line.
But if you look at the overall portfolio, we have 6 year-round beers, 3 of which are in the 5% ABV range. So all of our seasonals tend to be a little higher in the ABV, and our flagship beer, the Loose Cannon, is at 7%. And then we move up from there. But the other thing that we are pretty big on is we are probably the largest producer of cask-conditioned beer in the country. And obviously, when we do that, we do a lot of our lower ABV, the pale ale, et cetera, is also available in that format. So,
did you come up to New York for Casco Fest?
I didn't.
No.
When was it?
There's one at DBA that happens once or twice a year, DBA in Williamsburg. That's pretty great. There haven't really been too many other regular cast fests.
Well, we're getting more and more involved in that. We own, at this stage, we own a little over 600 firkins, and we also have 12 actual wooden barrel firkins, which are awesome. So we're developing this more and more as a it's a niche area within a niche, but it's certainly, we love it. We think cask beer is the finest possible expression for draft beer, so we like it a lot.
We saw in New York a few years ago there was this huge interest in cask, but we felt that breweries were just kind of putting anything in a cask and shipping it off. So you'd have Imperial IPAs in casks.
Right.
And it's kind of ridiculous because we usually import some nice English casks ourselves, like Thornbridge.
Right.
And so we've kind of, we feel like that we're waiting for some more American producers to make like English style, you know.
We can help you with that.
Goes, yeah, that's what I was thinking.
We can definitely help you with that. When you do it, do you do just put them on the bar or do you actually
use
a beer
engine?
We
put on the bar and we do gravity pour and we hope to go through it in 2 nights.
Right. I'll show you something when we're off air because we've invented the first American caskerator. So you can actually put it on a beer engine and if you hook it up correctly, the beer will last for a week to 10 days.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, if we want to talk about cask ales, I mean, you know, in New York there's Alex Hall, and for years he had the Gotham Imbiber, and he was preaching, you know, the places that serve cask. And when we opened, we got a small system from him. But there are a couple of things. One, that the system didn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing was I didn't really think the styles of beer were consistent. You know,
really?
It was just, well, I said there'd be an Imperial IPA, an Imperial Stout. It was just too off the charts for me. I'm a purist. I think I like cask ales that are, you know, sessionable, bitters, pale ales.
I like them, although I got to tell you, the Loose Cannon and cask format is amazing. I mean, it's 7%, a little over that, but it's truly an amazing beer. I like it a lot. Can you tell?
No, I'm looking. I want it. Well, then we got to get you up. You know, we've been talking about doing some kind of cask event for a couple years.
Yeah.
Our friend Bruce Williams from Williams Brothers has been saying how he wants to come over here and compare American versus English and Scottish.
We got a silver medal at the Great British Beer Festival for a cask of Loose Cannon a couple of years back. So.
Yeah. Actually,
took it to the mother country.
Actually, Hugh will be meeting Alex tonight, who's here for the media event that Hugh's in town for. So
that's great.
For that discussion a little more.
So, what's your opinion of cask beer in America?
I think it's certainly work in progress. I think all of us, including ourselves, need to get a little bit better at it. Although we've been working really hard at it for a number of years now, I think it is incumbent now upon the suppliers, me. To do a lot more work educating the retailers, you, on how to properly dispense and care for the product, because I've gone into too many places where, you know, the beer has clearly been past its prime and they're still serving it, and that's not doing the consumer any good, it's not doing the public any good, certainly not doing the supplier any good. But I think that it's a clear growth area in the category. So, I mean, we love it. Like I said, we're not backing down.
And when did you first get interested in cask ale?
Well, I first learned to drink beer in England in 1974, so that was kind of the beginning of it. And then we've been a serious producer of it now for probably 9 or 10 years. I had a guy working for me who was a huge lover of English-style ales, and he beat me up and beat me up and beat me up saying, "You got to do this." I said, "I love it, but it'll never sell." Well, finally, I took the bait, and the rest is history.
It's great to hear you talk about it. I mean, it's really just what we're looking for. Like I said, a few years ago, people were getting caught up in the cask ale thing. And at some point, whether it was our technology, it was the choices of beer, it just wasn't really working for us.
We really look at it from the standpoint of, in every market that we do these products in, we look for 3 or 4 key retailers who are willing to commit to doing it right. And if they'll do it right, then we'll support the hell out of them and make sure that the beer was, that they can have consistent supply, not just ours. Obviously, we want to encourage them to try other products, but that the quality will be good and that the consistency will be good, and that's the name of the game. If you're going to commit to putting a few dollars into equipment to dispense the stuff correctly, we want to make sure that we don't let you down.
Hey, that's really great, Hugh. Hey, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in a few minutes and talk more about cask ales with Hugh Sisson from Heavy Seas on the Heritage Radio Network.
You're listening to Andy's Biscuits by Pamela Royal on the heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome back to Beer Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Hugh Sisson, the founder of Heavy Seas Brewing, and we're talking about cocoa nibs and beer and cask ales. Hugh, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So what were you saying about your really great beer, the Siren Noir? It's got cocoa nibs.
It's a chocolate imperial stout that's aged in bourbon barrels. And what I was saying was we made a slight change in the process this year when we released this beer. We just used cocoa nibs. There's no cocoa powder. There's no chocolate syrup. There's none of those. And it's almost like a dry hopping thing where you just put the nibs in the liquid and they have contact time. And it's a much more subtle approach, which is why when you taste the beer, it's dry. It doesn't have any sweetness per se, but the dark chocolate character is clearly evident. But it's a process. And when we were first developing this, you know, I'm drinking this beer out of the tank and I'm going, my God, where's the damn chocolate? I don't see it at all. But my brewing guy basically said, patience, Hugh, patience, patience. And slowly but surely it did come up. And what's interesting is the character has developed nicely since it's been in the bottle. So it's coming along pretty nicely. We like it.
Yeah. What did you say about it, Bree? Well, you like it?
I said it touched my girly little heart.
It sure doesn't. I just gave you a refill.
Let that be a hint to dates out there everywhere.
All right. So you get by the Heavy Seas Siren Noir for your date.
Siren Noir, the black siren.
The Siren Noir. All right. So we're talking about cask ales, too. This is something I didn't know about you, and it's pretty fascinating. So tell us about your cask program and what you're going to do to really do the right thing and showcase your beers properly.
Well, we're doing a couple of things. Above and beyond the fact that we've made a pretty significant economic investment into owning the cooperage, which is kind of a big deal. As I think I mentioned earlier, we also have, in addition to 600 stainless firkins, we also have 12 actual English wooden firkins. And those are cool because you get the wood nuances as well, which is sort of a whole other subset that we're working on uncharted water. They are awesome, but they only happen when we're going to be actually hand-delivering the beer because I don't trust putting a $500 barrel in the back of our distributor's delivery trucks. I mean, nothing against those guys, but they'll drop it on the sidewalk once, and that's $500 right down the crapper. But anyway, we have all that, but the other thing that we're really trying to focus on now is the educational materials and equipment for the retailers. And we're about to start marketing through our own website what we call a caskerator, which is a way of dispensing cask ale in such a way that it holds up for 7 to 10 days for the retailer. So if you want to do cask ale and you don't want to have to worry about, you know, if I don't sell it in 2 days, I got to throw it out, or the beer going off, well, we have a solution for that we can supply you with. That allows you to do cask ale correctly. I mean, cask ale properly dispensed is awesome, and cask ale improperly dispensed is, okay, I'm not all that excited. So
what are the features of your caskerator?
Well, it's basically it's a kegerator that's been refit, so we create a special wooden top, and we mount a beer engine on the top, and then as it goes through to tap into the cask, we've got some hardware sources that we get from a company called UK Brewing Supplies, and they can supply you with the stuff. We'll just put it all together for you, which is called the cask widge and then a breather. And what, in effect, you do is that the widge allows you to tap the cask sitting straight up and down, not on the side like you would normally. But what happens is it skims the beer off the top so that any sediment's going to stay below, right? So you're not drawing the sediment into the glass. Secondly, instead of allowing air to come into the vessel, you allow about 1.5 pounds of CO2 blanket pressure. So it's not enough to actually carbonate the beer, but it is enough to keep the beer from getting oxidized. And that's the whole secret to the whole thing, is don't let oxygen come in contact with the beer. If you tap it, you put it on the bar, you know, as soon as the beer starts coming out, oxygen's going into the vessel, which means that the beer's going to have, you know, 24 to 48 hours tops. That's not where you want to be.
Yeah, I've heard about these kind of systems, and I know that some bars in New York have had using CO2 and other systems.
Right.
I myself feel the other way about cask ale.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the guy that I want to put it on the bar, and in one night I want to go through it.
Well, we like that as long as it goes through it in one night, and that's you know, a little program that we're trying to develop, and this could be kind of a fun thing to do, is we do cask-offs. So you get two bars in the same town, or maybe two bars in different towns that have got sports teams that are going to be playing one another, And they both tap a firkin at the same time, and then the first bar that empties it, you know, gets a couple of T-shirts and kind of shit like that. But it's fun.
Well, that's what I really feel like. That's what casks up again, because I feel like that for years there have been some systems like this. The cask. In fact, we had a caskerator from UK Brewing Supply when we opened.
Right.
And you know, I'm sure there's been some changes, but after a while, it wasn't really working the way we wanted to. And we've chosen to, we'd rather have things like pins.
Right.
There's also the nice German style upright casks from Bamberg.
Right.
That are like probably about the size of a pin.
Right.
And we prefer to promote it.
Well, if you're going to do it on the bar, the pin is the size.
Yeah, but we put it up and we'd like to go through it in one night. That's
absolutely
our idea.
That's the best way to do it.
And I feel like the other systems, I feel like then you're competing with draft. And this is definitely worth another conversation. But I mean, it's a big question. It's like, what's the value of cask?
If you can do it right so that you don't have to worry about the quality going down and losing product and profits, I think if you're in the, I mean, you're a great beer bar. If you can offer cask-conditioned ale on an ongoing basis, that's a point of differentiation between you and your competitors. And we're all looking for points of differentiation.
Well, it's true. I mean, people come in and ask for it all the time.
Right.
And like we said, we've chosen the tack of doing, you know, one or two
well,
every couple weeks.
Yeah, come down to Baltimore. I'll show you the toys, and then you can make a decision.
You know, in New York, there's something like a DBA. Alex Hall set up some systems. Is that a similar system to what you're doing?
I haven't seen those, so I'm not 100% sure. Although, I mean, this is not rocket science. It's just pure common sense. But the fact that we're gonna put it all together so that if you don't want to piece it together from this guy, here's something that works. You know, we can send it up to you. Boom, there you go. You're in the cask business. Plug and play.
Ken, are you a fan of cask ales?
I do. There's where I live in Boston, there's a very well-known cask festival that I go to, put on by NERAC.
Right, we're doing that.
And there's just a mouthfeel to cask ale that just can't be equaled, I think, out of a bottle. Or if it can, it's really, really difficult to do. So yeah, I do like those. Sometimes also you are dealing with lower carbonation, makes them maybe a little more sessionable in general. And the great thing about it, just like the great thing about craft beer in general, is every cask is different, and there's just such variety that is out there. And you know, cask ale is really the embodiment of that as well. Hugh, what did you just pour there?
This is one we did. We're not doing this in 2013, so this is our Below Decks barley wine, except in this particular instance it was aged for a year in Cabernet barrels. So
I can taste that. It's great.
Yeah, it's pretty interesting stuff. You know, you got a little bit of the wood. There's sort of that prune, plum, raisiny characteristic that comes from the Cabernet fruit. I mean, talk about something that screams pair me with cheese. This is right in that area right there, but it's just...
Why don't you scream it?
Pair me with cheese!
were you an actor when you were younger?
Actually, I was. My degrees are both in my master's and my undergraduate degree are both in theater.
And are you from Baltimore originally?
Uh-huh.
Well, it's a great town. You know, our friend Brian Strunka, he's got the Gypsy brand in Stillwater.
I know Brian.
And he opened a bar, didn't he?
He did. He's got, it's called the Love and Regret. And he's got that little pub over in the Canton part of town. So I haven't seen him in a while, but he's
What are some other cool places in Baltimore to go to?
Well, probably the number one beer bar in all of Baltimore is a place called Max's on Broadway. It's just, it's an awesome beer bar. They literally just this past Valentine's Day weekend is when they do their annual 72 Hours of Belgium. And they'll have in one place over the course of 3 days probably 350 to 400 different Belgian beers on tap.
That's amazing.
It's truly amazing. I mean, he gets... I mean, he starts getting one-offs from breweries that don't distribute it in this country. He'll start working on next year's probably tomorrow. But that's an awesome event. Obviously, the Heavy Seas Ale House would be high on my list. There's some great joints. Alewife's got a presence down there as well. So, good stuff.
So Baltimore's a good town.
Baltimore's a good town. Baltimore's becoming a better and better beer town all the time. It's been a good, it's been a nice town with a lot of neighborhoods for years. You know, we're like any other relatively major city. You've got your good stuff and your not so good stuff. This year's been a great year for sports, so we're all pretty happy about that.
All right. Do you think that being from Baltimore, does it inform your taste in beer?
I don't think being from Baltimore has anything to do with my taste in beer.
there is Natty Bo, which is
absolutely horrible. Famous. World famous and hasn't been made in Baltimore in 20 years, so...
But you spent time in England when you were young.
Yeah, I first learned to drink... I was a college student that didn't like beer, and in 1974 I went to London to study theater. And I walked into the pubs and I started drinking beer, and I said, damn, I like this. This is a whole lot better than what I got back at college. So that, unfortunately, was the beginning of a very slippery slope. Then what happened... how blue can I get on this radio?
Get blue.
Okay. So in any event, I'm an acting student finishing grad school in 1980, and my father calls me up and goes, okay, actor boy, what are you going to do now? And I say, okay, well, I'm going to go to New York. And what are you going to do in New York? I'm going to do what every other actor does in New York. I'm going to wait tables and tend bar. And he said, okay, that's great. Why don't you come to Baltimore and wait tables and tend bar for me? As you know, I just opened this little bar, and you could get your fanny out of hock, and then, you know, then you can go to New York after you're out of debt. I said, that's not a bad idea. So that's what I did. So I show up in Baltimore. I've been back in Baltimore for 20 minutes. I walk into the bar. There's my old man leaning at the bar. He goes, hey, how you doing? Very good. Reaches in his pocket, throws me the keys to the front door, and as I catch him, he goes, okay, don't fuck up, and walks out the door. And that's how I got in the goddamn bar business. So that was the beginning of what ended up being, as I said, a very slippery slope. So those are
why is that a blue story? You're talking blue states, red states?
No. Anyway.
You probably blew through a lot of money.
That's right.
In that bar this year or two.
And did you develop your taste for beer when you had that bar?
I did, but I'm sure like you are, and like you are, and that is that once I found myself in that industry, you know, if you're going to be successful at something, you need to be a student of your industry. So I decided that I was going to learn a whole lot about wine and a lot about beer and a lot about food, and that served me well. I mean, as I mentioned to you earlier, I've been doing the wine reviews on the NPR stations in Maryland for 24 years. And that was a direct result of that. And that's been, you know, so it's been a lot of fun. I mean, you know, learning about beer and wine and food and a whole bunch of, this is interesting. It's not like it's terrible work. So I've enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun.
You feel like an actor, you know. He's got a vest on, and you know his hair is combed just right. If you could see him, you'd want to talk to him. And you have a good voice too.
Well, thank you very much.
So NPR, the Baltimore NPR station. What's that?
It's called WYPR for your public radio, and then there's a. Then there's an Eastern.
Just emptied my glass on the floor.
There. This is the.
Cheers.
Is this the Greater Pumpkin?
Greater Pumpkin.
Okay, this is the one we make every year.
This is and your beer theme.
This is your food and your beer theme, and this is the bourbon barrel aged pumpkin ale.
It does. There's a nice spice in there. It's a little assertive on the spice, the pumpkin spicing.
Well, it's
but the nose is nice.
Oh, the nose is great. And again, a little assertive on the pumpkin spicing, but put it with some food, and it stands up great.
Yeah.
If you wanted to have this with Thanksgiving dinner,
pork chop. Work well?
Yeah, works really well.
I like Imperial Pumpkin's not a bad style.
Uh-huh. It's not a bad style. And it's funny, I'm not a huge pumpkin ale fan, and I'm becoming a fan of the bourbon barrel stuff, but one of the things that we do with the bourbon barrels is we don't do anything for more than four or five weeks max. Because we think if you leave it in the bourbon barrels for too long, it gets way too boozy. So the less is more has been our approach. And when my brewers, who insisted that we make a pumpkin beer, came to me 5 or 6 years ago and said, okay, now we want to put some of that in these whiskey barrels. I went, oh, God, this is going to be horrible. And I really liked it. And this little beer's got its own little developing cult following, so it's fun.
No, they're really tasting great. We've got a few minutes left. Let's ask another question.
Uh-huh.
Pick a few other breweries that you really like.
Okay.
And also anyone else you think is doing a nice job with cask ales.
Okay, other breweries that I have a lot of respect for. Victory is always high on my list. I've known those guys for a very long time. Ron Barchet, one of the principals at Victory, actually got his start working at the number two brew pub that started in Baltimore. So I've known him all the way back.
Which one was that?
That was called DeGroen's. So I've known him all the way back to 1989 on all that stuff. I think they do really nice work, high quality operation. Other companies that I'm particularly respectful of, I think the guys at Trogs are doing a really nice job. Obviously, Sam at Dogfish is doing a nice job. Our friends up in Frederick, which is just another part of Maryland, Flying Dog, they're doing a pretty credible job. So those are a couple people right off. And I try to focus most of my energies on the quasi-mid-Atlantic area. So those are the ones that immediately come to the top of mind. In terms of the cask area, obviously Firestone Walker is a major producer of cask ale. So I would say that I've got a lot of respect for them and what they're doing with that program. You know, fortunately, most of their stuff isn't coming out here, and fortunately, none of my stuff goes out there, so we're not kind of playing in the same space. But that's certainly a company that I have a lot of respect for in that area.
And are there any rules for you about shipping your casks? I mean, will you ship them in the summer? You know,
now we'll ship
weather
them.
Issues.
We'll ship them in the summer. We don't really have any major issues with that. The only rules that we have on our casks is the wooden ones, and that is that literally if we're going to do a wooden cask event, we'll drive them up, do the gig, and then we'll drive them back, because if they get dried out and the staves shrink, then the barrel's shot. But that's fine, because that gives us an opportunity to come up and do a gig and work with some folks. And have
do you feel like as long as they're refrigerated shipping and refrigerated warehouses, you're comfortable with the
I don't
casks?
Really think I'm really not that concerned about refrigerated shipping on our casks, and the primary reason for that is, okay, we make it, it goes into a temperature-controlled storage space. If that's going to come out of that for 48 hours, I'm not that concerned about it. If it was going to be something where I'm going to put it on a container, on a cargo ship for 3 weeks, in the exposed to God knows what kinds of temperature, that's a different animal. 24 to 48 hours on a live beer where yeast is an antioxidant, so that I'm not that concerned about. I mean, I guess, yeah, if it's 112 degrees in the back of the truck, that might be an issue. That's probably going to be more of an issue for filtered beer than it is for unfiltered beer.
Why is that?
Because, as I said, the yeast is an antioxidant. For a short period of time at the warmer temperature, the yeast is actually going to protect the beer from oxidation, whereas bottled beer that's been filtered has no yeast to act as the antioxidant, and as the temperature gets, I forget what the exact ratio is, but for every 5 degrees over 65 degrees, the rate of oxidation doubles. So at 75 degrees, the rate of oxidation is double what it would be at 70 degrees. That can be an issue for a beer that's not protected by the presence of yeast.
You know, that's the coolest thing I heard in about 3 years. Thank you. Because people always talk about, I always thought that filtered beers were more stable, and the big breweries make those arguments,
right,
for filtered beers.
Right, they are more stable, but heat is never the friend of beer. So and the big IPAs that everybody loves, they are the most delicate of all the beers. I mean, you want those as fresh as you possibly can get them. Everybody thinks that, well, IPA wears like iron. Bullshit. It needs to be kept cold and it needs to be consumed quickly. Because otherwise, all those big floral hoppy aromas oxidize right down the crapper.
Wow, that's a great point, man. It's really great having you on, Hugh and Ken from Heavy Seas.
You're listening to Shop Till I Drop by Pamela Royal on the HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Sessions Radio on the Heritage Radio Network. This is Jimmy Carboni. I'm live at City Winery. It's the heart of New York City Beer Week. New York City Brewers' Choice, the best event. It's our third year doing it, and we're here with one of the brewers, Jeff O'Neill from Peekskill. He's got a great story to tell. He was a brewer at Ithaca Brewing, and now he's with Peekskill up in the Hudson. So, Jeff, tell us a little bit what you're doing at the new brewery and what you've been doing for New York City Beer Week.
Well, I'm really glad to say that we're more or less up to full speed at our place, at the new place that we spent last year building in Peekskill, just a block north of the Peekskill Metro North stop. We opened around Christmas time, and I think tomorrow I'm going to get up to 10 beers for the first time on draft, and we're making some fun stuff and using our cool ship every day that we brew. So we're doing something that's a lot of fun, and the site is really beautiful, and it's a great day trip up from the city. So hoping to drum up some day trip traffic with our New York City Beer Week events. Last weekend we went, of course, to the opening party at Galapagos, which was a lot of fun. And then Saturday night we went to the Third Avenue Ale House, which just opened 6 weeks or so ago. Is that right? 6 weeks?
I think a little longer ago. But
and Tim Stendel's here, also from Union Beer, who helps rep Peekskill. Tim, tell us about some of the highlights of Craft Beer Week so far.
Well, this is the first time that Union Beer has had the opportunity to really sell Peekskill products. We used Craft Beer Week as a nice launching pad for the brand in New York City proper. So we're lucky enough to be working with Jeff and Michael Benz and the other guys at Peekskill. And so, honestly, trying some of his stuff has been the highlight of the week for me so far. But I've been setting up a lot of events, and I'm looking forward to tasting the fruits of my labor as I go to some of these events with all these specialty products that are making their way into New York City.
Tim, you're an awesome rep. I mean, you're more than just a beer rep. You're a home brewer, and you organize some very cool events. What's coming up next for you? That's something called the Wild Things?
Where the Wild Beers Are is May 19th at the Gutter in Brooklyn. It's essentially a big bottle share. It's a collaborative event that people can use as a platform to try new sour beers, to share their sour beers that they've been hoarding or keeping for however long. It essentially creates a venue for people to share these products and talk about sour beers and wild ales and saisons, farmhouse beers. It's a lot of fun, and you get to try some crazy stuff that you didn't even know existed.
And talking about sour beers, let's go back to Jeff. One of the things that people are really talking about are your sour beers and this cool ship that you're building. Tell us a little bit how you got started with that. That's really a good story. Most people in America don't really know about it. So tell us about the cool ship and your sour beers.
Well, we incorporated a cool ship as sort of our third brew house vessel in our process. So we don't use it just for beers that are intended to be sour, but sort of in addition to and in lieu of a whirlpool vessel. So we're having a lot of fun using it. We're running really, really clean worts because we're able to cast out into this cool ship that's very shallow. And the beers are turning out really super clean. And as the weather warms up, we're going to start actually using the cool ship for primary fermentation. Starting tomorrow for the first time, actually, we're hosting Jason Perkins from Allagash and Megan Parisi from Blue Jacket that's about to open in D.C. for a collaboration brew. Megan's also putting a cool ship in her brewery, and Jason's going to come and show us how to both make a white beer and use a cool ship. So we're having a lot of fun, and it's a great time to be doing this. And thrilled to be at this event.
Well, tell us more about the cool ship. I mean, what do you have to do to? It has to be naturally spontaneous yeast. Are you putting in yeast?
No,
are you
no,
putting cobwebs in the ceiling from England or something?
About the actual vessel itself, like it's not just for wild fermentations or spontaneous fermentations, but it used to be how they would cool down wort quickly before really refrigeration technology existed. So as you cast it out into that shallow sort of pan, it sheds heat like nobody's business. And just in the 15 minutes that it takes us to flood it, the temperature comes down almost 40 degrees. So it's really interesting. It ties in well, not just to the very romantic sour brewing that people are so infatuated with, but also historic American brewing. Like we make a brand called Hop Common that's a San Francisco-style lager that one of the tales about how the style was named was that it would make steam when they pumped the wort up to the roof into their cool ship. So cool ships have been used a lot of ways and are still used in German lager breweries and German ale breweries more often than you'd know, but there are very few in the U.S. So we're using it more as a day-to-day brew house vessel for all of our worts, and it allows for quick settling and dropping bright, but we'll also start to do some as the weather warms up where we can do fermentation in it. We'll start to do that.
So another thing I don't know about sour beer. So do you have the same standards of sanitation and cleanliness when you're working with sour beers as you do your other beers? Or do you have like I've heard about people leaving cobwebs from 100 years ago or something.
We have this beautiful stone cellar in the building that I'm going to start filling with wine barrels. And it's a different environment than the very sanitary brewery that we have upstairs, but you still take the same precautions. Like, you use sanitary technique when you move stuff around. Barrels themselves are somewhat open environments for oxygen uptake and so forth. So it's sort of two different styles of brewing, but you use the same precautions all the time because you want to keep your clean side clean. But we will, that said, we will sequester long-term sour stuff into our proper cellar.
And Tim, you know, for your Where the Wild Things At event, I always say
where the wild beers are.
Yeah. So are you just doing commercially made sour beers? Are people doing homebrew as well?
Well, for the first few years, we did allow homebrew, but there are some legal issues that go along with that. So we can't allow homebrew anymore, unfortunately. You know, if something sneaks in, there's not a whole lot we can do about it, but we try to keep everything to commercially made sour beers, wild ales, saisons, just in the farmhouse bent, and that's essentially the premise of the whole event.
Well, we're looking forward to that. And Chief, they know you as Chief, but just say a few more words about the new brewery and how you can get there before we sign off.
We would love for any and all of you to come and see what we're doing in Peekskill. We're right on the waterfront, just a block north of the Peekskill train station, which you can access on the Hudson Line out of Grand Central Station every hour at the slowest. It's oftentimes trains are every 20 minutes. So please come and visit us and see what we're doing, because I think it's a special, very different thing that we're doing up there from what most facilities are like. So,
well, thanks for coming down to New York City Brewer's Choice. It's the middle of New York City Beer Week. I always keep muffling it up.
Tell you something. I want to say how excited I am about Scotty doing the keynote tonight. I think the first time they did this event, we had to import a keynote speaker. And now we have, you know, a legitimate homegrown talent that's really been along and driven for a large part this ride that has been the last few years in New York City. And I'll say to anybody who's listening that doesn't live or drink in New York City, come visit us, because it's something else. And I say that having been almost everywhere. So thanks for having us to your event. It's a great, great event, great beer week.
Thanks, Jeff. That's a great closeout. I'll just say thanks for coming to New York City Brewer's Choice. We're here at City Winery. You can hear everybody setting up right now. You know, glasses clinking, and the place is filling up. Most of the brewers are here, most of the foods. We're going to have a great night, so I'll sign off. Thanks for listening, and this is Jimmy Carboni, Beer Sessions Radio.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.